Welcome to episode 62 of Meenal's World. It's so lovely to be back this week. Last week, I couldn't release an episode because we had a bit of a technical disaster. And instead, I decided to go ahead and release my first newsletter, which has been on my to-do list for a very long time. But the reason I released this newsletter was because for me, the podcast has always been a way of understanding the world around me and sort of making sense of all the chaos around us. And because I didn't go through that process of editing a podcast, listening back to somebody else's story and journey and editing it, it almost felt like I missed a week of therapy. So writing that newsletter was another outlet for me, and it really helped me. So I hope it helps you as well. And if you haven't subscribed, you can do that on my website, meenalviz.com. So enough about me, and I'll go in about talking about my guest. This week, I sat down with Jolie. Now, she's the founder of the campaign group Pregnant Then Screwed. And most of you may already know about her work throughout the pandemic, which was really focused on protecting pregnant women, not just from the virus, but protecting them in their financial and employment status as well. Now, Jolie's story starts all the way from when she first fell pregnant and faced discrimination in the workplace, because it's something that she didn't expect and it changed her life forever. Then all of what she was feeling, all of what she was experiencing turned into this massive and now very successful campaign group. And I'm sure you'll leave this episode full of hope and inspiration. So without further ado, here's Jolie. Welcome to the show, Jolie. It's so lovely to actually just have an hour with you.
A whole hour, uninterrupted hour.
How are you doing, Jolie? How have you been over the last, well, couple of years, I'd say, but, you know, everything with Pregnant and Screwed, I'm sure, has just changed your life forever.
Oh, yeah. Well, Pregnant and Screwed has been going for 7 years. It was our seventh birthday in March on International Women's Day. So that was quite a dramatic change to my life. Obviously, having children is quite a dramatic change to your life as well. And then we had a pandemic and we're still in it. And that has also been quite a dramatic change to my life and to everybody's life. And I also had my hair cut very short last week. So that was quite a dramatic change to my hair.
Pregnancy, haircut, same thing.
I mean, you know, similar dramatic changes there.
Yeah. I did actually cut my hair really short as well before I gave birth. I just thought if one thing's going to change in my life, I might as well just change everything about me as well.
Yeah. And you really don't want to be spending lots of time washing your hair, do you? When you've got no time to do anything, you can barely make a cup of tea. So making everything as simple as possible is a good thing, I would say.
So I actually listened to your audiobook because as a mother, I barely have time to even have a glass of water, let alone read a book. So everything I do is on audio. But I remember specifically where I was as well. I was in the park with Radhika and I was just standing under a tree, just watching her chase like the squirrels or whatever she was doing. But you said something quite important. And that was that you said that your background and your childhood was quite comfortable. You never thought that things were bad in the world and, you know, things were quite comfortable for you. And then you were pregnant and then the life just, you know, the world that you knew completely changed. Now you have your own kids as well. And how are you trying to make that blow a bit softer for them? Because I went through the same thing. I never even spoke about racism in school or with my family. Then I come here and, you know, it's a whole different game. It's a whole different ball game. And now I'm trying to figure out as a mother, yeah, how can I make things a bit easier for Radhika? So how has it changed been for you?
Yeah, I did have a very comfortable upbringing. I did, apart from the fact that my dad was a bit of a rogue and you know, my parents have separated and they had a relatively unhappy marriage. Say relatively, it was a dreadful marriage. And I definitely think that has fed into my work, my experience of seeing how unhappy they were and how different their lives were because my mum predominantly was a stay-at-home mum and my dad went out and brought home the bacon and worked very, very hard. He was never at home. I never really saw him apart from a Sunday when he would watch Formula One in the living room. So I always associate the Formula One soundtrack to my dad. But, you know, it was very comfortable in that I had a mum who was brilliant and was there constantly. And we had enough money. And so I never had to worry about money or poverty or anything like that. And also didn't, you know, I did, with hindsight, experience sexism without a doubt, but I didn't see it as sexism, really. I didn't see the world in that way. I just sort of thought these are the things that happen to women. I remember applying for a job, and it was actually at one of the music academies, and I went for the interview, and the guy who interviewed me turned up at the pub later that night, and I was in the pub, and he put his hand on my leg and said, if I slept with him, then I'd get the job. And I said, no, you're all right, mate. Thanks very much. And went home and didn't get the job. They gave the job to a man. There was another incident where I was working, and a client we had that had loads of money used to feel me up under the table, and I would just sort of push him off. And just sort of accepted it. And then, you know, had other more sort of traumatic experiences that are related to me being a woman. But just never sort of thought about it as sexism, or, you know, saw myself as a feminist until this really dramatic experience of being pushed out of my job when I found out I was pregnant. And then finding out I was having a high-risk pregnancy and the baby would probably die. And those two things colliding, ending up feeling like my career was over, but also that this baby was going to die. And I remember lying on a sofa, feeling like I'd lost my job and that my body was useless and was completely failing me, rubbing my belly, begging this baby to stay put. And it radicalized me. You know, those sort of 4 weeks was like a blindfold had been lifted, and I saw everything completely differently. And I realized there and then that I'd lost, you know, this was about me being a woman. This was sexism. This is what feminism is really about. And then I couldn't unsee it once I'd seen it, and I saw it everywhere. And so obviously that's what triggered Pregnant Then Screwed, although it was another year and a half before I actually set up Pregnant Then Screwed. But in terms of how preparing children for the things that we've been unprepared for, I think the key is simply to talk about it. And nobody ever talked to me about sexism or feminism or gender stereotypes or race or racism. You know, we've had to have those blindfolds removed through quite extreme experiences in order for us to go through that learning. And I'm doing a lot at the moment at teaching my kids who are boys, but both boys, about gender stereotypes, about consent, about race, about racism, in the hope that we fix this for the next generation.
Well, you made a really good point there, Julie. You said having these really extreme experiences causes that change to come in. And I think that's what the pandemic has done in some way. We've seen so many difficult truths simmer to the surface, whether it's related to childcare, to feminism, to the politics that, you know, that control our country, to the NHS. And it's been a really hard blow. And, you know, lots of people have lost their lives. Lots of people have suffered. But I also feel like we've learned a lot. And that's what we need to be doing now as a society, sort of getting all of those things that we've learned and taking it forward. But do you think that there's a way that we can continue this learning as a society? Do you think that we're moving towards that, where we're just trying to create a society that understands what's going on without having to face these extreme situations?
I don't think, this is going to sound really negative and I don't mean it to. I think with our generation, it will take a lot to unlearn some of the stuff we've already learned. And I think we've already seen from the pandemic that there were some positives that we could draw from that. This understanding that people who are in more vulnerable positions, Black, Asian, ethnic minority people, people who are low-income earners, women, mothers, pregnant women, have different experiences to other types of people. And that was talked about a lot during the pandemic. really opened the door to understanding these inequalities that we experience. And also there were positives such as working from home and looking at flexible working and all of that sort of jazz. But what we've seen now that things are opening up again is this massive pull to go back to normality, in inverted commas, this real drive from usually white, powerful, usually men, to for things to just be as they were before the pandemic, for nothing to change. And that is incredibly frustrating because we've had these 2 years of real hardship that are still continuing for many, many people. And so to see that we're not going to learn anything from that is really depressing. And I don't want to sound too pessimistic because I am an optimist and I do have hope that things will change. I just think that we have got to not give up, and we've got to make sure that learning is front and center of what we're talking about constantly, to remind people not to forget what the learnings that we can take from the pandemic.
I think it's very it's a good point that you made, that you know, this is a lot of, there's a mixture of unlearning, learning, and we're trying to sort of balance the scales all the time between different generations, different societies. It's going to be very difficult. But I think that we have to also look at it from a personal point of view and a society point of view as well, that on a personal level, what is each individual doing? Because I still remember when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening in the US and here as well, we saw everyone was putting a black square on Instagram. And at that time, I wasn't a fan of that because I knew that within 24 hours, 48 hours, people would just be talking about something else. And that's how the news cycle runs. And this is how our lives run in this digital world. But I do think that the onus has to be on focusing on a personal responsibility as well. You know, you have to ask, if you're complaining about something, if there's something that you don't like about the system, well, are you doing something to create a change? You don't have to physically do something, but are you learning about it? Are you unlearning? Are you trying to help? Even at home, and this is why when people talk to me about activism, I'm like, just like charity, it does start at home. Are you having those difficult conversations with your mother, with your father, with your husband? Because that's where it all starts. But Julie, what I wanted to ask you was, because the pandemic's changed so much for you, for Pregnant and Screwed, I want you to take me back to that day when Boris Johnson came on the news saying, we're going into lockdown. Now, as doctors, obviously, we had an idea that this probably was going to happen because we're healthcare professionals. We knew how the virus was going to work. I know a lot of people outside of the NHS weren't sure because the government messaging was so terrible. But what happened to you? What happened to your organization and to your system on that day when Boris Johnson came and said, we're going into national lockdown? Now, in your head, you must have had, oh, childcare, women are going to be suffering, pregnant women probably might leave, you know, not have their maternity rights, lots of things going on. Talk me through that day.
Ooh, I mean, I can visualize the moment when he said, you must stay at home, and thinking, wow, here we go. And actually, you know, before that, waiting and waiting and waiting for them to mention pregnant women, because we, and I'm sure you and many health professionals, were thinking, hold on a minute, there's a vulnerable group of people here that have just been completely forgotten about when you're doing your planning and thinking about how this virus affects people. And it was first mentioned, pregnant women were first mentioned, I think it was the 14th of March, by Chris Whitty. And he said, we're going to put pregnant women in the vulnerable group. We don't know the impact of this virus on pregnant women. We're doing it as a precautionary measure. And that was the first time pregnant women were mentioned. And I was sitting downstairs and I remember cheering, like watching it on my laptop and whooping, because finally somebody had remembered pregnant women. And then when we went into lockdown, we were absolutely inundated with calls from frantic pregnant women who didn't know whether they should be going into work or not. They had no idea whether, if they worked outside of the home, should they be getting on the tube? Should they be going to stack shelves in a supermarket? Should they be working in care homes? Should they be, what were their rights? And none of us had any idea. We had no clue. All of the organizations that work on these frontline services like ours had no idea what to tell them. And so we had to do a lot of unpicking of like, what's the law around this? What, you know, talking to different lawyers, trying to figure out how we could tell pregnant women what their legal rights were. And frankly, the government was completely useless on it and they had given it no consideration at all. And so we did, we working with lawyers, figured out what their legal rights were, managed to publish information. The number of calls that we had more than quadrupled overnight. We were a tiny organization. There were two of us. Me and Sarah Ronan and a bunch of brilliant volunteers. And so our work quadrupled overnight and our kids were at home. So our work doubled in terms of unpaid labor and paid work quadrupled. So it was really hard. And I was so scared about what was going to happen to pregnant women. And it went from dealing with women who'd lost their jobs or experienced discrimination to our work being about life or death. Of course, Minal, you will be used to this, but I was not. And I was so scared that something was going to happen. And I still struggle to talk about it because it really was the first time where I felt responsible for a bunch of vulnerable women. And so we were doing everything we could to try and keep them safe, to give them the information that they needed, to try and get the government to do something, to publish safety guidance for pregnant women, to keep them safe, to say, if you're pregnant, don't go to work. Don't work outside the home. Stay at home. It's too dangerous. And they didn't. And then Mary died, who obviously, you know, I didn't know, but because it felt very personal because, and still does, because we'd been working so hard for that not to happen and then it happened. And then Selena Shaw died. And, you know, then there were more and more stories of pregnant women dying and still the government did nothing. And it was 9 months. It took 9 months for them to publish any safety guidance for pregnant women. It turned up on their website in December 2020. And in the meantime, it was a confusing hodgepodge of messages about what their legal rights were, what their health and safety guidance was.
It's funny, Jodie, because I can say this, I swear I can say the story 1,000 times and I'll still tear up. It's just one of those things that changed my life forever. And I'm sure it did for you as well, because for me, I saw the world through a completely different lens. And like you made a good point that you felt responsible for so many women who were coming to you saying, I need your help. And it was a matter of life and death. And yeah, I mean, you can't say that I was used to it, but nothing prepared me for a global pandemic. Nothing. There's nothing in my medical books, nothing in my training that prepared me for it. I also remember very clearly where I was when Boris Johnson made that announcement. And Radhika, I think I was 6 months pregnant or 5 months pregnant at that time. And that was the nice time when you're starting to feel the kicks and you're starting to enjoy your pregnancy. Then all of a sudden you're told to sit at home. And Nishant said to me, he said, Minal, I'll book you a flight to Gibraltar, go home, stay with your parents and just get out. You know, the issue was with us, Jolie, was that not only was Nishant working in A&E, but that night before his story with The Guardian broke, he was like the first whistleblower. And I knew he was going to get into a lot of trouble. I knew that it was going to be very, very difficult for him to deal with everything alone. And I said, look, I'll stay. I'll stay with you and whatever support you need, I'll be here. And I stayed quiet for some time. I mean, people thought I was, you know, out there campaigning from day one. I wasn't. I stayed quiet because just like a lot of women coming to you, they were scared of losing their job. And, you know, with a baby coming along the way, I couldn't afford to do that. But it was Nurse Mary as well that changed everything for me. And we, you know, we talk about systemic injustice, racism, inequalities, everything. That story has everything combined together.
It does. And that was it. It was a woman who had given her whole life to helping others. And you know, from reading her story, you could see that she was an incredibly kind, selfless, fun human being who already had a son. And was pregnant with her daughter. And so somebody who had given her life caring for others, and then nobody was there to care for her when it mattered. That's what hit me really hard. And that, I mean, talking to, obviously, we both have since got to know Ernest, her husband, and what a kind, good, brilliant man he is. And talking to him about his son and daughter and what Mary's sadly missed out on, because I feel very strongly she was let down.
Mm. At that time, Julie, there was a lot of momentum with the media, with the public in general. You know, there was an outroar. Like, why is this happening? Why are our politicians behaving this way? Why are there no measures put in place, not just to protect pregnant women, but to protect those on the front line? You know, we need more clear guidance. And I worry sometimes, Jolie, that now 2 years on, I mean, I look at the calendar now, it's almost 2 years since I protested. And I try to read the public's feelings about what the pandemic was like. And, you know, we're still seeing the government doing stupid things. And I still feel like they're getting away with it. Do you think that that emotion has become diluted now?
Yeah, I do. I think not only is the pull to get back to normality from those in power, I think generally the public are keen to sidestep what happened over the last 2 years and move on, because it's too painful and it's too traumatic. And you can't hang on to that anger without going a bit mad and without help. You know, I mean, I've had to have therapy to deal with it because it sent me bananas. You know, if you're a general member of the public, I mean, it's my job to care about this. Obviously I do anyway, but if you're a general member of the public, yeah, the temptation is to want to get back to normal, in inverted commas. So yes, I do think it's become diluted, definitely.
But then how do you work as a campaign group to try and make the message just as clear as it was 2 years ago? That must be quite difficult now, right?
Yeah, it is very difficult. And it depends what you're talking about, because there were so many issues. There was pregnancy and lack of health and safety guidance. Then there was, of course, the issues around the vaccine and pregnancy, which you know a lot about, Minal, and the lack of clear communication about the importance for pregnant women to be vaccinated, and the impact that's had. And then also there was lockdown and the kids being at home, the fact that mothers were doing three times the unpaid labour that fathers were, according to all of the data, and the impact that's had on their earning potential, but also their mental health. And if you look at what happened, if you were pregnant at the beginning of the pandemic, you have had to go through issues of health and safety, being terrified that you may get COVID, and we now know that you are more likely to sadly die. You're more likely to end up in ICU. Your baby is more likely to be born prematurely and more likely to be stillborn. So you had all of these fears and anxieties. Then you were going to hospital appointments on your own. So you're going for scans. 7% of women gave birth completely on their own. 50% of women had to wear a mask during labor. So, you know, going through labor can be really traumatic in and of itself. Then you take the baby home, hopefully, and no health visitors are coming. You're doing health visiting online. You can't meet your family and friends. They can't come over to give you a pat on the back and a cuddle and tell you it's going to be okay, or stay with you for a couple of weeks to make meals and to, you know, just make you feel good. NCT isn't happening. You know, those groups, mum groups, baby groups are not happening. So you haven't got a peer support network. So understandably, there was data last week that showed that the number of requests for mental health support for new mums has increased by 40% since 2019, 40%. And we are inundated again with calls from women saying, my mental health is on the floor. I can't cope anymore. I'm not coping. I mean, that's entirely understandable when you look at their journey and how horrendous that has been and how little they've been considered in government policies.
I remember when I was going through the pandemic, but and also going through my legal case with the government, which was extremely stressful as well. And then obviously I gave birth, and that was in itself another really stressful time, doing it all alone, like you mentioned. And it's only now when I have conversations like this with you or people on my podcast, and I start to reflect on the emotional impact that had on me, how I kept giving and giving and giving. And I kept showing up every day. I kept showing up to the news interviews. I kept showing up to those phone calls to tell people what was really happening on the front line. And I didn't give myself any time to sort of just take a break and take some time for me and Radhika. And I really regret that. You know, that time for me was very difficult. But what people see on the headlines, what people even see with Pregnant and Screwed, a successful campaign group. But it does have a it all comes at a personal cost. It is very difficult to run these campaigns, and it is very difficult to have a family. You mean, you also wrote a book, Jolie, in the middle of all of that. So you went through a hell of a lot. Did you realize what you were going through at that time? Or has it only taken you to come out of the pandemic slowly and start to really reflect on it to realize what impact it had on you?
I mean, campaigning is losing. You know, I've got very used to making demands, asking for things, running really full-on intense campaigns, getting to the end and nothing's changed. You sort of have to. If you're going to be a sustainable campaigner, you have to accept that each time you the likelihood of you being successful is slim to none. But you've got to take solace in the fact that if you're talking about this and you're getting newspapers to cover it and you're getting people to engage in this issue, the change is happening. It's just slow and incremental. And so I take my the reason why I feel I can keep going, I take my energy, if you like, from the support services that we have. So we run a free legal advice line and a mentor scheme, and the feedback we get from people to say how that changed their life and made a massive difference, you know, gives me the energy to keep going. So yes, I mean, I didn't, when I was campaigning, particularly on, you know, pregnant women, the fact that it wasn't getting through was absolutely incredibly frustrating. And as I said, because it was life or death, it made, you know, a big difference. But I'm sort of very used to losing. What I wasn't used to was I stopped sleeping because I was so stressed. And so I wasn't sleeping. I was trying to deal with the kids and be positive for them and trying to deal with this really very serious issue. And the death of Mary, without a doubt, was really traumatic for me. And I don't want to make it about me, because my God, it's not about me. It's about Mary, you know. But I didn't realize the impact that had on me until I had a bit of a breakdown, actually, not that long ago. It was once things had opened up and I was did my first live talk for an event in London. And I went before the talk, I'd felt really off anyway. I did a naff job of it. And then it was the next day, I just burst into tears and I could not stop crying. I cried for 3 days solidly and was in an awful state. And my board got me a therapist very quickly to try and figure out what was going on. And it was the therapist that said, "You've got vicarious trauma. You're traumatized from what's happened during the pandemic. You really need to deal with it." And so that was the first time I'd realized, you know, because you just bury things. Well, you bury and bury and bury and keep going because you feel like you have to, and because you feel that, well, I certainly didn't see the point in reflecting on all of that, but actually it was really important to take the time to do that. And so I'm still in recovery, as it were, from that trauma. You know, I don't think it's fully healed at all, but I certainly feel a whole lot better than I did. I was a mess for a short period of time. And so I think, you know, anybody that's campaigning on an issue, the notion of self-care, which I rejected for a couple of years, I didn't like the term at all, but actually I've realized the absolute importance of reflecting on what you're doing, reflecting on your mental health, making sure that you're looking after it as you keep going, because otherwise you know, you'll crack like I did.
And what did your kids say to you when, you know, you were in such a state where you broke down? Did your kids see what was happening? Did they see the impact that this had on their mother? Or
I don't think they understood it. No, they didn't see me crying. I just sat in front of the TV for 3 days and watched really trashy telly. I think I was Married at First Sight Australia, which, you know, I would highly recommend, and got like takeaways each day and just tried to rest and like heal myself. But they were just very, you know, they'd come over and give me a cuddle and could obviously see things weren't quite right. But you know, nothing more than that.
And what's it like now, Jolie, at this stage of the pandemic where, you know, we've got more answers than we had 2 years ago? Do you think things are better now for women and for mothers and pregnant women? Or do you still think that the change you wanted to see hasn't really happened?
No, I don't. There are some positives. And I think certainly with the vaccine and the fact that pregnant and breastfeeding women were unable to access the vaccine until April because the drug companies hadn't included them in trials and drug trials. Well, so our data found that that was happening to about half of pregnant and breastfeeding women, even when we knew the vaccine was safe and we had the data to demonstrate it. When they were going to vaccine centres, they were being, or speaking to their GP or their midwife, they were being put off from having the vaccine by a health professional. And that's not okay. And has resulted, of course, in some women dying. And so I think the shock of that has mobilized some organizations and some women to ensure that doesn't happen again. And I've seen action and activity around that to make sure that pregnant women, breastfeeding women are included in drug trials. So they're included from the outset, and to ensure that that communication, once we know a vaccine is safe, it trickles down through to health professionals. Because, I mean, yeah, my hairdresser last week, who I was talking to, I asked her about family, and her sister had been going through IVF and had had to have numerous operations on the fallopian tubes to try and so that she could get pregnant. When she was going through this, they had told her not to have the vaccine. This is Christmas just gone. They told her not to have the vaccine because they didn't know how it would affect fertility. Of course, we know it doesn't affect fertility. It's Christmas. And she got COVID and she died.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, the fact that it's still happening, and we look at what happened in other countries where from the moment that we had all that data, predominantly from America, that showed it was safe in pregnancy, the language and communication changed from you can have the vaccine to pregnant women are prioritized, you must now have the vaccine. The number of women who were vaccinated is more than double of what we have in the UK. And it was, so part of the problem is that pregnant women weren't included in these vaccine trials. Part of the problem is a lack of consideration from the government. Why were they not looking at this data and going, prioritizing pregnant women from the outset? Why were they not doing that? And, you know, so I think they've got a lot to answer for in this as well.
From the outside, yeah, it sounds terrible. But for me, it's like, well, it sounds like a very normal response from our government. Because for me, when I was working in April 2020, just before I was sent home, Jolie, I still remember crying and begging for a mask. Because we didn't have enough masks to go around, the surgical masks. It wasn't even a specialized one. I just wanted a simple mask to cover my face. That's it. And I remember on the ward saying, I've just seen a patient. I need to change my mask because of infection control. And they were like, you have to use the same mask all day. And you just think, how have we allowed this to even happen? How have we even allowed this to be a conversation in a hospital where a pregnant woman is begging for a mask and they're saying, actually, we can't give you one because that's what the rules say. You know, no one ever thought, okay, look, she's pregnant, poor girl, let's just give her a mask. Like one mask down on the list isn't going to do anybody any harm. But they were so indoctrinated in those policies that made us believe that those policies were right. It was like almost like everybody was institutionalized. Every time I spoke to a manager and said, look, I don't think this is right. This is what we need to do. They said, no, but my boss said that. And I think my boss is right. So does your boss have a medical degree? No. Is your boss a doctor? No. So yeah, they actually don't know what they're talking about. And this was all these narratives that were playing within the, you know, what we're seeing in the public, where you're saying that women who are breastfeeding weren't encouraged to get a vaccine. It was happening in the hospital. You know, the same language and the same sort of communication was happening within the hospital. So nobody knew what was going on.
Yeah. And now you wonder if when people are very scared and they don't, everything is in flux, you don't really know what's going to happen and where things are going to go, that people are more likely to follow rules to the letter without questioning them. That's clearly what happened a lot during the pandemic, that people, you need a leader. You need to revert to somebody else who you feel is in control in order for you to not feel discombobulated, for want of a better word. And so the problem was that the leadership was hugely and enormously lacking in terms of their ability to put things into place at speed that they needed to put into place, but also lack of data and knowledge and information. But none of that was communicated. So we just followed things to a T, didn't we? And we did. Like, the general public stayed at home. We didn't go out. We predominantly did everything we were told to do. And that's clearly played out in the hospital setting as well.
Yeah, it has. And it's a shame to see how, instead of using healthcare workers to actually create change, they were actually suppressing us, saying, you need to be silent, you're not allowed to, you know, to speak your opinion because we're going to tell you what to do, which is what it basically was. And now that we talk about Russia, Ukraine, we talk about far right, we talk about Trump. And I, from a personal point of view, I do feel it's happening in our own country, but because it's happening in such an insidious way, maybe a lot of people aren't really willing to accept that. But I do think it's happening.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, yes, I would agree to a point, yeah, that it is in this country. And, you know, I very much disagree with them, with many of the conservative policies. And I do, without a doubt, feel that issues of sexism, racism, the needs of people on low incomes are just not on their agenda. They just seem to be entirely lacking. And we've seen just this week that the long promised employment bill, which would look at issues around employment, would have had an impact on P&O workers, for example, would have an impact on pregnant workers and flexible working requests and all that sort of stuff. They've shelved it, you know, last minute. So it's definitely not a priority. And you know, we've seen issues around race, the same thing happened, gaslighting around whether racism exists, and really not prioritizing many of the issues that come to the fore, such as, you know, the fact that four times as many Black women die in childbirth.
And can I just add to that, Julie, that statistic came out in 1999 in the Aitchison report. So it came out a long time ago. And we're still talking about the same statistic, and we're still talking about the same issue. So they just bosh out all of these reports, and then we don't really see much change. But that's why people like yourself are needed to keep raising the alarm bells. And I'm very grateful for everything you've done, Jolie. On a personal level, you helped me a lot. And I still remember it was about May 2020 when you dropped me a message on WhatsApp saying, "Look, Mila, do you want to just have a chat?" And you called me, and I remember where I was sitting. I was sitting in the kitchen on the chair. And you said, "Mina, look, this is going to be a very difficult run, because I told you I was taking the government to court." And you said, "Mina, take care of yourself." And I was like, "Yeah, it's fine. Like, everything is okay." Now that I look back at it, your words really held a lot of value. And now, a lot of people were against what I did, Jolie, but the very few people like yourself really kept me going. So thank you so much for everything that you've done.
Well, thank you for doing it. It was a very brave, courageous thing to do. Yeah, it's hard as an individual to stand up for the rights of many others, particularly when you know that you will come up against people saying, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Are you mental? Or making you believe that you'll never succeed. So well done.
Thank you, Julie. And just before we go, because I know we don't have much time left, what would you say to someone who's in the position that you were in all those years ago when you were about to have your first child and you lost your job, and someone wants to create change, someone wants to have an impact on the world? What would you say to them? What would be your advice?
I would say that if you experience something and you don't find the solutions to that problem, or you don't find people that can help you, then there are other people that have experienced that, and that, you know, if you build something, they will come. That would be my first thing. I would also say, don't ever think somebody's going to come along on a white horse and save you, because nobody's coming to save you. You know, we've got to save ourselves. And I made that mistake. I put out these stories of women who'd experienced pregnancy, maternity discrimination, thinking, you know, people just knew that this was happening, then we could stop it all. Somebody would come along and go, oh, okay, this is happening. Okay, I'll just go and fix that then. And of course, that didn't happen. And eventually I realized that nobody was coming to save us. And so I had to do more than I was doing. But there is so much that you can do with very little, because you'd be absolutely amazed how many people will support you, how many people will get behind you to help you. If you put a call out for anything that you need, you'd be amazed at how many people respond and say, sure, I can help you with that. So don't be put off by a lack of resource to do it. But do, when you start it, think about a long-term game plan, because, you know, you'll burn yourself out after 2 years. You have to have a long-term plan, a financial plan to keep you going.
That's what you said to me. You said, I remember when you said to me, you said, Meenal, if you, being an activist or a campaigner is actually a privileged thing to do if you don't have to worry about your bills and stuff, but this is actually something that does take a toll on you. And I'll always remember that, Jolie. That will always stick with me.
Yeah. And you can run on passion only for so long. And no matter how deeply and passionately you feel about something, it will come to an end unless you have a model of sustainability to take you forward. And so you should start looking at that as soon as you can.
Yeah, it is. But I also think, Julie, you know, when people are in positions like this where they face an extreme situation like you did and I did, and then there's a part of your brain thinking, actually, maybe I don't need to do it because somebody else is probably doing it, or somebody else has. And one of the things that I've learned over the last 2 years, and even speaking to guests on the podcast, I mean, I've spoken to many journalists, many activists, but everyone can actually change something in a very unique way, because everybody's experience is actually very unique and there is a change waiting to happen.
And don't be afraid of that either. I mean, as a, you know, born and bred northerner, spent most of my life in Newcastle, the notion of influencing Westminster was so far removed from anything I had experienced. It just didn't even cross my mind. You know, I didn't know who any MPs were. I wasn't like that politically minded, and never ever thought that I could influence anything that was happening at a political level. And I only got to that place incrementally by trying different things and seeing, oh, hold on a minute, they actually do want to listen to what I have to say. This is quite amazing. So don't ever feel that you don't have any power. No matter who you are, where you come from, you do have power. You do. And you know, just take look at other people like you, Meenal, who have managed to make a difference with very little and with no experience of campaigning previously. You really can make a change.
Oh, thank you, Jolie. And I just want to say as well to everybody listening, if you do anything, order Jolie's book, because I feel that book should be given as soon as someone finds out they're pregnant. They should just be handed this book. It's the perfect combination of humor and real life experiences. And I really wish this book came out earlier and I would have read it, but it's a brilliant book. So I encourage everybody to get their hands on it. But what if people want to help you out at Pregnant and Screwed? Is there any way people can get in touch with you, or what kind of system do you have?
So I'll take that compliment on the book. Okay. Yes, so we're always looking for people to work on our free advice line, which we're always looking for people that are trained in HR to work on a free advice line. And then if you have any of the specialist skills, whether it's to do with research or data analysis or PR or anything like that, then get in touch, because we have a massive volunteer program now. We've got over 100 volunteers working for us and doing a variety of different things, from working on our advice line to our mentor program. So we pair up women who are going, who are taking legal action against their employer with somebody who's been through that process as a peer-to-peer support program. And then we do all of our campaigning and lobbying, and we're about to do March of the Mummies on the 29th of October in 9 cities across the UK. So we'll be looking for stewards and volunteers to help support with that in the different locations across the UK. So loads of opportunities to support us. Go on Instagram, we're pregnant. _then_screwed, or you can email us on hello@pregnantthenscrewed.com.
Thank you, Julie. I'll leave all of these links in the show notes, as well as the link to order your book. But thank you for not just your time today, but for everything that you do. And thank you for paving the way for our children and for Radhika as well. When she grows up, I'm surely going to tell her your story and all the incredible women who've worked over the last couple of years to create change. So thank you, Julie.
Wow, thank you, Manal. That was lovely.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week. I'd love to hear all your thoughts, not just about this episode, but any of the episodes that you've listened to. And feel free to let me know if there's anyone in particular you'd like me to speak to, because this podcast really is for you. And it kind of is for me as well, but mainly for you. Because I'll always try my best to bring you the stories that help you in your own journey as change makers and activists, or any sort of career or any sort of vision that you have for your future. And if you are listening on iTunes, please do leave a review. And if you are on any other app, please do subscribe. These small things can really help the podcast go a long, long way. You can follow Jolie on all the channels that I've left in the show notes. I've also left the link to order her book, which, as I said, I highly, highly recommend. You can also find me on social media at Dr. Meenal Viz, or on my website, meenalviz.com, where you can also get in touch. Thank you all for tuning in again this week. It's so lovely to be back, and I really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Have a lovely week ahead, and I'll see you all next Friday.